Welcome to the Out of Space podcast, hosted by me, Kathy Lomax, featuring artists from Across Spaces Studios in conversation with writers, critics and art professionals, offering a closer look into what happens behind closed studio doors. Over the next 8 episodes, we will be exploring the theme of care from multiple viewpoints, ranging from artists and parenthood to caring about the community and about the work itself. This series was recorded remotely in order to adhere to social distancing rules, and there may be variations in sound quality. Out of Space, a podcast by Space Studios. In this episode of Out of Space's Care series, we're going to be looking at community. That is, the support networks and groups of artists that come together in both formal and informal ways, as well as the idea of working with communities of people in a wider sense. It's notable that this year's Turner Prize shortlist is made up entirely of artist collectives. Tate Britain director and chair of the Turner Prize jury, Alex Farquharson, stated that, and I quote, "After a year of lockdowns, when very few artists have been able to exhibit publicly, the jury has selected 5 outstanding collectives whose work has not only continued through the pandemic, but become even more relevant as a result." To talk about collectives, communities, artist-led and artist-initiated activities, and consider how being in an artist gang can be empowering, I'm delighted to welcome 2 artists, Serena Corder and Emma Cousin. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hi. Hello. Hey. Hello. Hi. So I'm just going to give you both a little introduction first before I start asking you some exciting things, I hope. Serena Corder works across performance, sound, sculpture and film, considering how communion, tradition and ritual shape our lives. Her interest in ancient cosmology, New Age philosophy and theories of quantum physics have drawn her to the imperceivable connections between nature, plants and animals, all bound together by vibration, sound and energy. Giving the rational mind and the imagination equal weight, she strikes a balance between the scientific and spiritual realms by creating multi-sensory experiences that make invisible and inaudible forces palpable. Audiences are often encouraged to participate at some point in her process, creating collective experiences that focus on the forgotten and overlooked. Serena was a Norman Lippen Baltic Fellow in Ceramic Sculpture at Newcastle University, 2016 to 2018, and her recent solo shows, which were all in 2018, are Missing Time at Baltic Gateshead, Daughters of Necessity at the Hepworth Wakefield, The Bell Tree at Trust New Art and Bluecoat, and Missing Time, a performance for the High Line in New York City. Which, they sound wonderful. Can't wait to find out a bit more about them. On to Emma. Emma Cousin is a drawer and a painter. She was born in Yorkshire in 1986, graduated from Ruskin School of Art, Oxford in 2007, and is currently based in London with a space studio at Haymull Road in Peckham. Is that right? Haymull.
That's how I say it.
Yeah, I couldn't work it out. Emma draws the things in front of her, things imagined and things felt, employing a darkly comic and irreverent parade of female characters. Her paintings, which explore ideas of support, mobility and progress, have a tension between the figurative meaning and the literal application. Emma's recent solo exhibitions include Introductions at White Cube London in 2021 and New Dirt at Goldsmiths CCA Gallery London 2020. Her work is held by museums and foundations in Latvia, Bangladesh, Lebanon, Malaysia and Italy. In 2015, she opened the project space Bread and Jam, which she ran from her home in South London for 2 years. And in 2020, she established the podcast Chats with Artists Under Lockdown, which I've been listening to throughout lockdown. It's been brilliant. So thanks for that. Nice. So welcome, both of you. Thank you for being here and for joining me for this episode. I thought it might be nice to kick off by asking you both a bit more about your respective practices. I mean, I know I've read those biographies, which are really great. But it would just be nice to hear from you a bit more about what it is that you do. So maybe, Serena, I could start with you. And I was thinking maybe you could describe a recent project in a bit more detail, just so we kind of get an idea of how your process works. Or
I mean, probably the most recent, a lot of things happened in 2018.
Yeah, obviously I had
I then had a baby, and then there was a pandemic, so you know, not great things that coalesce brilliantly with the art world, giving birth and stuff. Sorry, I am on a bouncing ball. Sorry, you got I'm on a bouncing ball. I didn't slam the bat.
Very cool. I was like, wow, she's got leather.
I wish I had that.
Anyway, so the Bell Tree was a project for the National Trust, New Art Trust, collaboration with the Blue Coat as well, in Liverpool's Speak Hall. And that comprised of 300 mushroom bells dripping from an old oak tree in the middle of their ancient woodland. And you were invited to come to the tree and listen to a sound piece that you could download on your phone, and be transported into this world of sort of fairy beings and nature spirits, all kind of going wild around the tree and trying to protect this bluebell woodland, which is where the tree is sited. And so it was very much delving into plant lore and folklore. I worked with a local madrigals choir to be my angry band of fairies, and so it's quite out of their comfort zone, and they came and did a series of workshops and sort of became these angry fairies, which was a lot of fun. And we worked in the woodland itself and in Speak Hall to do the recordings, and I also worked with some bell ringers who were local, you know, we created a way of improvising with bells, which was really a lot of fun. I recommend it to anyone.
Wow, so that sounds so great.
So it was a combination of all those things. And then I worked with a group of singers that I'd been working with on a whole series of projects that year called Mouthful. And they sort of brought the whole thing together. And I kind of created this sound piece that is about 20 minutes long. And I think you can still download it from the National Trust website. But the tree sadly has been taken down, but it was there for a whole year, and existed through gales, storms and all sorts of things. All these porcelain bells kind of remained, and that was the piece. So there was a lot of engaging with local community in a way, but also in a way that it's a lot of my work. The concept drives how I participate with people. So the concept comes first. It's not, right, I'm going to organize this thing and engage with this group of people. But it's really the work that drives that participation, because essentially it's driven by an idea of ritual and communion, and it's whatever that work needs, I seek out really to help make that work happen.
That sounds such a great piece of work. I really wish I'd seen it. I haven't been to Liverpool for so long. I've really, there was something else that I was thinking. Obviously, the biennial's coming up, isn't it, soon? So Liverpool seems to be this place that keeps coming into my mind as somewhere I need to go to, even though I've missed the tree, sadly. Emma, can I sort of go over to you now to ask the same kind of thing? Maybe you could just tell us a bit more about your paintings and drawings, how they look. Are they big? Are they small? just something about some recent projects you've been working on, maybe.
I love it. I just kept thinking about the angry band of fairies and the mouthful. I love that word, the mouthful. It's quite a mouthful actually to describe your practice succinctly, I think, which is always really funny.
Yeah.
Especially when it's like, is it big or small? It's like, that's amazing.
I'm just imagining that if people don't know your work, I just kind of want to have, I mean, obviously they can look you up and they probably know you anyway, but just so they have an idea of...
No, I totally get it. And it's a great question, because the idea of scale is really interesting, isn't it? Like in terms of how you translate that audibly, which is interesting. But Yeah, so the reason I say drawer as well as painter is because everything really starts with drawing. And I always say it's like I've got some kind of like visual, it's like a sort of toretic thing almost. Like the images come often very fast and fluid, and it's almost like trying to get them out of my mind so I can slow down and do things and be methodical and, I don't know, pay attention, not be overwhelmed by them as well. So drawing has become like, has maybe it has always been a way of like dealing with everything in the world, a way of having fun, a way of reflecting, a way of trying to make sense of things, especially language. So a lot of my work is about an interest in language or linguistics and the failure of communication and language. So the gaps in between. And that obviously includes, I say obviously, I haven't described what the work is yet. It obviously describes body language because generally the pieces are a body of figures, so a series of figures, often odd numbers, so 3, 5, 7, 12, etc. Well, 12's not, 13. and playing with ideas of a system. So they're just essentially articulating an idea, literally illustrating it out as if they were kind of telling you, like, this is what we're doing, without really giving an explanation of why they're doing it. So there's often a tension to me as well in terms of, is this a positive act or is this a really antagonistic or damaging or threatening act that's going on? And I suppose I'm always reflecting on the way, you know, on life, on living, on the way we are today, you know, in society, and the sort of the pressures we're under, as well as gravity being one of those pressures. So like having a body, being a body, being of other bodies and trying to exist together and trying to communicate. So the figures are always up to, and it's like what they're up to. They're always up to something. And there's a lot of fun to be had with that. So the drawings are a way to really explore that and kind of exhaust those possibilities to the point where some new revelation happens, which then becomes a painting. So they tend to be quite big, just to address the actual question. They're always life-size. So they're basically defined by human architecture. So for instance, the way I worked that out was I was with my mum and her partner, and he was like, why don't you think about the height of a door? Because that's a human thing. And I know that sounds really basic, but it's like it's 190 centimeters, the height of an average door. So it's like the perfect measurement to go off. So almost all the paintings are 190 centimeters high, unless they're stacked figures, in which case they're multiples of that amount. So it's a really nice, actually logical way of deciding what size the paintings need to be. Having said that, recently I heard something that Tala Madani said about the egos that paintings have, and that you should decide the size of the painting depending on the ego of the idea. And I'm completely obsessed with that concept. So maybe my formula will begin to change. And I'm now thinking about like small paintings and treasure and searching for little jewels and what that would be. So it is changing in terms of scale a little bit at the moment, but generally they're massive. Yeah. And if anything, as big as the last drawing, which was in the CCA gallery, in Goldsmiths, CCA Goldsmiths, was a huge, like five by 8 meter wall drawing, which was made with a massive scaffold over about 2 weeks. And that was a real way to like actually play in the space with these physical proportions, which were actually just over life size, responding to the door in the gallery rather than the door at my, like a domestic door.
Yeah, that's great. I love that idea about the size and ego. It's really fascinating. What I'd like to do is to dive right into this idea of community and ask you both whether you think community is important to artists. I know that's a bit of a huge kind of question, but I'm sort of thinking about the idea of the isolated genius, that sort of myth of the artist as an isolated genius, and how it seems maybe more true to say, I think, that creative people actually thrive in a community. But I don't know, have you got any thoughts? Is it anything that you have been thinking about?
I mean, I guess my practice is so much to do with engaging with people. And it's sort of part of who I am as a human being. And also, I can't think of anything in the natural world that doesn't thrive or that thrives in isolation. And I think we've all experienced that sense of being isolated this year or year and a half. And it's just sort of, I think everyone's sort of desperate to be together. I think it's just part of human nature that we need one another. And I think in terms of creativity and making, I used to have a space studio, and I do actually miss going into a space studio. I mean, now, because of the way my life is, I need to be able to dash downstairs and into the garage and be able to make my work. And that's because I've got a baby. But, you know, I do miss those interactions and conversations that I would have even on the way to, like, using the toilet or something. You know, our studios were quite a friendly place. I know not all studios are like that. Not every studio I've been in has been like that. But just on that level of, even if you are an artist that doesn't engage with communities, I think you still need a support network as a human being, just to remain sane, really.
I'm really interested, Serena, because you used to be part of a collective, Walk, Walk, Walk. And so you've actually been, you know, closely associated with that kind of artist gang. Could you tell us a bit more about how that came about or how it felt doing that?
I mean, that came about from out of friendship. Essentially, because I was thinking a lot about collectives and how they're formed and how they're quite different from the way that I participate with strangers, essentially, and bring groups of strangers together to do something. That really grew out of living in the same place, so a sort of locale and being near each other, and being friends and having a kind of resonance with a sort of similar set of ideas and an ethos that we wanted to examine. We all worked very differently in our individual practices, but we appreciated each other's input and difference, I suppose. We embraced that difference and we kind of learned a lot from each other. And I think, yeah, it gives you a power, I suppose, in a group. I mean, actually, my days of being in a kind of artist gang go back to being at my degree at Middlesex University, because collaboration wasn't a module on the, you know, I think a lot of students are sort of forced to collaborate now and experience what collaboration is as part of their course. But this was just, it just evolved out of the fact that we were all sort of in this sort of melting pot of wanting to kind of work with each other, and the tutors didn't stop it, and they really embraced it, and they saw we were producing good work, and they just sort of you know, encouraged it, which was amazing. And I actually graduated as part of a collaboration with a very dear friend who isn't with us anymore, called Ian Johnston, who's an incredible artist, who's much older than me. So there was a lot of mature students at Middlesex as well. So I think that sense of creative collaboration with other artists and making was really born there and made permissible and acceptable. And then that sort of carried through into then working with Gail Burton and Claire Coleman as part of Walk, Walk, Walk. So it also comes out of having no money, essentially, to make anything. And you have big ideas and you want to do something, and you can kind of pool your resources and kind of make things out of nothing. And you learn that very quickly, you know, as a collective, those things grow and multiply very quickly. But yeah,
and I think walk particularly, I guess, because the practice was based on walking, wasn't it, or devised walks, and
it was based on a very routine walk that we did. So it sort of came out of the everyday, the ennui of the everyday, and kind of like finding the extraordinary within it, and kind of focusing on this one area and like mapping it, and then inviting other people to come and do things in that space as well. So it was like our playground. So there was an element of kind of reclaiming the streets, because we did lots of night walks, but then we had people like Ty Shani came and curated a musical walk, you know, because we were all friends then. That's sort of how collectives grow and movements grow.
That's amazing. And Emma, over to you for your thoughts on communities, but also I guess particularly I'd love to hear more about your podcast and how the idea for that came about, because it seemed to me like it was a really sort of empowering or engaging, generous idea for you to really I don't know, just to delve deeply into someone else's work and to have that really great discussion with them about their work. So, yeah, can you tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to think about this idea of, because I'm a painter and I am on my own in the studio pretty much, you know, the whole time. So this kind of solipsistic or individualistic perspective is definitely present. But I also think the more I was thinking about it, the more I thought everything is collaborative, because actually I am in a studio block and I'm really lucky to have great neighbours, and we meet for lunch all through the pandemic. We've been lucky enough to all be there, if anything, more than ever, and meet every lunchtime and sort of reflect to the fact, talk about, you know, and it actually feels like maybe thinking about this gang thing. I mean, I love that artist gang, like that's so cool. And I think it's so funny because I always wanted to be in a gang. Like I feel like thinking right back to what you were saying about graduation, Serena, about being at uni, that I was the opposite. I felt like I wanted to be this like individual, and I wanted to make a mark, and I wanted to, you know, have something to say, I suppose. And I was still trying to find that voice in a really big way, that I was struggling quite a lot. I wasn't great. You know, I was sort of like a bit young and a bit wet behind the ears and a bit green and really keen, like really over enthusiastic. So and very reverent of authority. And I think that's also problematic when you're coming to those kind of things. So I didn't really have any perspective of that bigger sort of gang idea. I didn't even consider that really until much later. And then it was, I feel like the podcast as well, almost everything has come out of a sense of like desperation and a sense of like, oh shit, this can't be what life is. This isn't, like, I'm not okay. This isn't good. And I'm not in a good place. And I think, yes, I was working for a gallery and set up Bread and Jam at the same time. And that was my first artist gang experience, where I was like hanging out with everybody, you know, it was in this house that we're speaking from now. So we were living in the house and then giving the space over to like 12 artists at a time. So it was a really immersive, it was like living in studios with artists all the time. It was just amazing. It was like a cult, I guess. Everyone keeps saying to me now, you basically want to live in a cult of artists. But to address the podcast idea, and I think that was my first taste of like, this is actually what this is what art's all about. This is what making is about. These conversations, even like cooking dinner together, you know, or trying to decide how to hang a shelf or like, you know, figuring stuff out, problem solving in terms of life as well. You know, like it's really interesting to hear about Serena's shift in terms of having a baby. Like those conversations with each other is so important. And that idea of support systems in that sense, you know, making room for each other, being generous with each other, remembering people and think, actually, this person's also got an amazing voice, we should listen for a minute, you know. So I think there's a lot of that I was realizing at that point. That was about 2015, and was really excited by, like genuinely felt like it saved me from pretty desperate situation of feeling like I just had to quit making art because I was so down, and making not very good stuff as well, because it was sort of around the weekend and, you know, you sort of felt like a bit of a hobby painter anyway. So I think the podcast similarly had that same energy of like, you know, everything was sort of cancelled or postponed for me immediately. So it felt like a year off without any idea of what was going to happen, the momentum of everything stopping completely. And I actually ironically was like, oh shit, I should have had a baby because this would have been like a really good time. Love that, Serena.
I just for the podcast, I was gesturing no, don't have a baby, but maybe not during a pandemic.
You know what I mean? I was thinking like if I was going to have a career break where I couldn't get into the studio. Anyway, so
do you know what? That's so interesting because I've been doing some teaching and a couple on a film studies course, and a couple of the students we've had are actually actors, like young actors, and they decided to go to uni just to because there was a pandemic on and there wasn't enough work.
Wow.
So
No, I think that's great. I mean, that was exactly it. So it was like, there's a gap. I mean, I also thought, like, I'm going to learn Italian. I'm going to start playing the violin again. Like, I had a lot of ambitions, most of which didn't happen. But I guess what the main thing was, like, this idea of, like, slight panic and really feeling, like, quite trapped by the situation. Like, you know, what can we do? What can I do? And through that kind of furtive desperation, started having conversations with, just thought, well, if I'm feeling like this, someone else will be. So it was just speaking to friends, really, on the phone first, just informal, like, how are you doing? How's everything? And I started to realize that everybody was in, obviously, everyone's shows were being moved, cancelled. Some people, and it just made me think, and obviously some people also have kids. A lot of people were teaching. A lot of people had elderly relatives. Some people, their relatives were abroad. There were so many complications that are way bigger than mine. And it just made me reflect on the whole thing differently and thought, actually, this is a time when we're even more of a community, actually. It's like a real leveler and this kind of unifying quality of, you know, it is a bit shit, but we're all in it together. And also it's scary, but there are some maybe positives, actually, because a lot of people are also having this kind of dilemma with kind of loving the time slowing down and the space and the different qualities like nature and, I don't know, going for walks, like all these kind of things, baking bread. And at the same time, feeling guilty for that or like struggling and then kind of resenting people who are doing, you know, so it was this whole world really that just felt like there's something in this. So I just started to have, I invited a few people to have these conversations. And as they grew, I guess by the third one, it made me think this is kind of something and I should try and think about what are the thematic sort of important things to talk about, like the difficulty of teaching online or the thing of having children and a practice or these elements and marking things like Grenfell's third anniversary whilst under a pandemic and, you know, kind of, I guess, more socio-political things as well with an awareness of that. But also just touching base on, I guess, the premise of that it starts with like, how are you feeling, which could be a whole podcast in itself. And then the questions were broadly like what's been discovered and what might have changed and what might have been lost in a person's practice. Because the other thing I realized was what I was really finding, I was wishing I could do is, which I think often artists, when we have a gap or a break after a series of work, we want to go to visit each other's studios. Like that's what is energizing and that's what where the conversations happen and all that kind of thing. So I was also thinking, whose studios would I like to visit? Who haven't I visited? Who had I planned to visit, et cetera, et cetera. So, and some of it was also really dear friends, someone like Louise Ashcroft, who is amazing, but we talk about like life stuff more than we talk about art stuff. So it was a way to actually get interested in each other's practice in a really like in-depth way. Yeah, sorry, that's quite a long-winded answer. But it feels like an extension of all that stuff, really, because it is that, you know, an ongoing curiosity into each other's practices.
Oh, that's great. I mean, and I really understand a lot of that because, you know, having run a gallery myself for like 20 years, and I haven't done it in the last year. We don't actually have a space at the moment. So I've really felt something missing, even though I was a bit like, oh my god, there's another private view and I've got to do this and that kind of thing, actually I do really, really miss it. And I think what I enjoy most of all is thinking about other artists' work and thinking about, in the most recent incarnation of the gallery, we all the shows we had were two-person shows, and I used to really like thinking about who would be in a show, who could be in a show with who, sort of like fantasy two-person shows, and the how there'd be some kind of weird interaction and what would happen. And just all of those kind of thoughts that you have, I think, when you are working with other artists and with a... Yeah, it's super nice and super creative. I think
it's interesting too, because it's that idea of friction, like the friction between two people actually. Like I love this thinking about music, like you put two notes together and the enharmonic starts to happen. Like when you clean your teeth with a toothbrush and it moves over this spectrum of sound, a bit like colour. And I often think about that with the podcast, that everybody who's been involved has also contributed to its development. And that's sometimes really simple. Like right at the beginning, someone was like, have you thought about putting intro music in the podcast? And I was like, oh shit, yeah, I should. Like, you know, I didn't know anything about podcasts. So I think it's also great that like being an amateur or being like a curious enthusiast is totally permissible in what we do. It's encouraged. And it means that with each other, with a community, it's possible, because you can say, I really want to do this and I've got the energy and the desire, but I don't know how to. And someone else will generously give that kind of assistance. So
yeah, and also sometimes the best things come when you don't know how to do it. I always think, because you just do it in a different kind of crazy way or something, and it's just, I don't know, it has something raw about it, which I always really enjoy.
But
what do you think about the idea that groups can be a bad thing, in that they become exclusive and can alienate people? I mean, I often think, I guess you can think about like the Mean Girls or something, I don't know, or just sort of the Royal Academicians, you know, like, not that they are the Mean Girls, the Royal Academicians, but there can be a real negative, can't there?
Yeah, I don't think all collaboration is brilliant. And, you know, I think you really need to know who you are within it. I think sometimes you can get lost within those collectives as well. And you need time to be able to step back from it or disband potentially, because you need to move on and find yourself again. You know, I think the reason a lot of things that the collaborations I've had with people have worked for a long time is because we've maintained our own personal practices as well, and not just let it all melt into one thing. So I think that's maybe sometimes where it can become dangerous. Also, I mean, I collaborate with lots of people, and that thing of learning through my work is like a major thing within what I do. I always want to be learning something new. And you know, I need to do that by, you know, learning from other people. And you know, that culture of generosity is there on YouTube, and that I started my own YouTube channel during lockdown out of desperation as well, sort of to connect in a way. You know, it's an invisible audience on some level, but it's not. Social media has become a massive thing. I mean, it was already a massive thing, but I think people realize how integral it is, how it's not going anywhere. It's sort of silly as an artist not to engage with it in a way that, you know, it's saved a lot of people's lives this year. And YouTube is just like, I learned so much from YouTube anyway. So as a place of generosity, you know, but also you can make money from it eventually if you want to like put that much work into it.
What do you do on your YouTube channel?
It's very much, it's called Serena Corda Ceramics, and it's very much focused on like the ceramic side of what I do in my work. So like a lot of my work sculpturally sort of became very focused on working with ceramics. And during lockdown, out of desperation, I started to make functional things, which have been amazing. And I think a lot of artists have done that too. And so we've seen this sort of flip and seen this amazing community grow, which is the Artist Support Pledge, which has also kept me going. And we've all kept each other going, you know, like that's the incredible thing. I think you can have, sorry, I'm sort of digressing from
I think that's great.
Dangerous things these gangs can be. But, you know, I think you can feel left out from anything, really. But I think it's about finding ways to open up your collective group. Like Walk 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 did open up to lots of other artists. And yeah, like Emma's doing, she's sort of finding new people that she might want to invite to the, if she continues the podcast, invite to that. And I think
maybe the thing is, if you do feel kind of shut out and excluded, is to start your own thing. I think that's probably why I started a gallery, because nobody else was offering me anything. And I was kind of like, well, if I don't do something proactive, then I don't know what really is going to happen. I'm, you know, like you were saying, Emma, you get to some point, you just think it's not really working at the moment. I need to do something.
Yeah.
And by I think, yeah, by putting in that time and effort and connecting with other artists, you can kind of make things happen, and it can be a little seed that starts and grows.
I mean, so, I think we're talking about like really positive examples of the group, which is great. But I do think there are issues with the group as well, in terms of like the I don't know, this kind of the potential for it to become anti-critical. Like if you're in an echo chamber and everyone's reinforcing, and you know, the same voice, the same idea, the same perspective, And if our role is sort of to challenge perspectives and come up with fresh views, they're sort of at odds with one another. So there are sometimes, I think, fundamental problems with that. If maybe it is about the longevity of the group, and I was thinking about, like, you know, take that, like great boy bands, because I feel like 90s boy bands are a really good like analogy for this. And then Robbie Williams leaves and then becomes like, you know, he's like left, he's gone on his own. But, and then the rest just you never hear about. And then other people pop up doing like children's TV. I don't know. It feels like quite an interesting analogy for like the group, because it isn't, I think that's a good, maybe that should be a rule. Like they're not indefinite. And I think if something has always, like, maybe some of the more, like we referenced one in particular, but some of the maybe more old school is like a way to describe them, groups have, you know, it's interesting to become aware of those problems and how to challenge the group, how the group continues to challenge itself, you know, in the same way that, sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, I think it's the idea of cliques that I always really hate. When you do kind of notice that there are certain cliques of artists around that kind of all, I don't know, yeah, support each other, go to each other's shows, and probably all like say how fantastic each other's work is. And they often tend to be a certain age and they kind of grow up together. And I've always really noticed it and really thought, God, I just don't want that to happen. So I'm always trying to, I guess, reach out across generations or whatever to just break down that idea of the clique. I'm just allergic to cliques.
I also think it's really important to acknowledge, like, getting critical feedback is like, that is so important. Like if you have someone giving you, if the group is giving you that, then that's a great group. Mm-hmm. If the group is just saying you're amazing all the time without any kind of, you know, I don't know, without any review, you know, sense of what am I trying to say, any broader kind of scope than that, I suppose, any kind of in-depth thing. And also the boldness to say to someone, to be direct, you know, to say, like, this isn't working, there's a problem here, have you thought about this, like, you, this is an ignorant position, I don't know, to challenge and criticize. And I totally agree, Kathy, that cliques often, it's about reinforcing, it's about feeling safe, isn't it, in a sense of belonging. So, and that's
what, and keeping other people out.
Yeah,
as well,
yeah. So I think that's something to be definitely wary of. So I think possibly it can. But I also think, you know, maybe those people are actually just quite insecure. Like, that's quite a nice way to think about Mean Girls. Like, oh, they're just a bit, they don't have the confidence to be on their own, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
<That's true>. So when you were running your gallery space, Bread and Jam, Emma, how did you go about selecting the artists that were going to show there? Did you have a policy, or how did it work?
I mean, I should say it definitely was like a pretty raw space. Like, it wasn't a gallery space in as much as it was, I guess it might be a project space, I don't know what the right word is, but like, it was in the house and it was derelict. Like, we were camping in one room, basically. So it was an amazing freedom in that sense. That the selection, you know, in some senses, it was started from, again, very humble, very naive, like, let's just do something and see. So inviting 12 artists to come and spend time in each room, in a space in the house. And then at the end of a month, we would open the space up to the public. And I remember at the beginning being like, maybe like 10 people will turn up to the opening, because, you know, it's in the middle of broccoli, like, no one, I don't know, Southeast London, like, it wasn't really for that in a sense. It, the community in that sense was for the artists. It was about the problem with space and the problem with money and the problem with studios not being available, and this kind of nexus of property versus value versus money versus, you know, making, where the creatives end up in that dynamic of gentrification and stuff. So sort of that was the idea. So it was very much like, who needs a space right now and who maybe can't afford one, or who is making great work, but you can imagine, you know, like, we talked about how big my paintings were, but imagine you were working in like your garden. You couldn't make massive paintings if you had like a tiny courtyard or something, or you didn't have any space or a spare room, or, you know, there's so many compromises that one has to make all the way through. But I think at certain times, especially when you're graduating, that's the case. And I also was very aware of like some older artists who I really respected, or I'd kind of come up with, who I just thought they should be better known. I kind of couldn't understand why these people weren't being shown in amazing gallery spaces. So it wasn't often people I knew. Often it would be through a network of other people. It's worth saying I ran the project with Rebecca Glover, who's a sound artist and Foley artist, and also Emily Austin, who is a curator and runs Austin Desmond Gallery in town. So I had this brilliant collaborative, you know, we were a collaborative team. And I, although it was me basically saying, do you think we should do this? And they just said, yeah, great, let's do it. What do you need? It did become this brainstorming of, you know, we kept a sort of black book, if you like, of like artist shows we'd seen or people that we knew who were struggling or who had an idea. I mean, often it's like that thing of people say, you know, you should always ask an artist what's their next project because that's going to be the one that they're really excited about and maybe never will happen unless someone makes it happen. So it was sort of that idea of what could happen if you just said yes to everything that you could. And because the space was so like derelict and run down and sort of we weren't that precious about the space because it, you know, you could have knocked walls down. It wouldn't really made a difference to how bad it looked. It meant that artists could come in and say, like, can I drill a hole or can I like actually knock a wall down or can I don't know, sleep in the space and invite like every relative to live with me. And I don't, it could be what it could, we could say yes to stuff. And that felt amazing. So that's sort of how we chose. We were doing some artist studio visits. Some of it was like, as well, there were one or two tutors that I'd had at Ruskin who were amazing. And again, I found that there were like Una Grimes, who is now much better known. But at that time, she's just an incredible person. And she's so generous and she makes brilliant work. And it just felt like it was something that I could offer that person who'd been so great to me as well and sort of say, I can offer you this.
I think it's really interesting that you talk about the people that you ran the space with and having, even if everybody isn't doing loads all the time, I think it's so important to have that sort of support and maybe affirmation or something about what you're doing.
I mean, I think also just it's like a confidence kick, isn't it? So if someone just to say, stop making excuses, get on with it. But it's also someone who, you know, it's very hard to do everything on your own. And I think we do as artists, we do everything, whether that's like the boring stuff behind the scenes or the really great stuff. So we can do it, but it's quite exhausting if you're doing that and a full-time job and trying to have practice. So it just meant that we could all bring a slightly different thing. And it's a bit like what Serena was saying about different people's skill sets as well. Like Rebecca Glover was really technically amazing and she knew about, you know, microphones and I don't know, where you rent kit from and TV adapters and stuff. I mean, I'm really not very techie. So that was amazing. And you know, Emily's just a very, very positive person and also had these connections to we loaned work from various galleries in town, which was amazing. I mean, that's like museum sort of shows where you pair contemporary artists with old modern British modern art. So all those things were kind of facilitated and possible and proposed in a collaborative way.
And I guess this is something, Serena, that this idea of collaborating with other people, drawing on other people's expertise, because you work across so many different media and art forms and things, you must use other people a lot to facilitate.
A lot, yes. I mean, although, you know, that question, I haven't really ever organised a show with other artists working per se in the way of having a gallery. But I think the bigger piece is that draw people in to enable them to work as a whole and draw on the skill sets of other people is just like, that's part of, I suppose, I'm curating something because you sort of feel like you're at the hub of something, like Emma said, you're sort of doing all these things as an artist and you're kind of directing and holding the project so that it comes together, but you are relying on other people's expertise at certain stages of that project to have it come to fruition. And I think you're seeing that more and more with very large scale things, people listing these, you know, credits really of who's been involved. You know, we do it with film. Why don't we do it in the art world? Why don't we give people the credit where credit's due of like, yes, it's my authorship, but this is, music's by this person, blah, blah, blah. So I think that's becoming more common, that these very multidisciplinary practices, and, you know, that's where I learned lots of things. And actually the sound element of my work came out of a really bad collaboration with someone who I you know, his ego got in the way of what we were doing. And I, from that moment on, was like not letting anyone do that to my work again. So that's where, for me, things can go bad, where there's a misconnect, where someone appears to be one thing and, you know, people change, and you know, a little bit of success of something changes someone sometimes in not a good way. But anyway, what was good for me at that point in my practice was that, right, I took the reins. I was like, this is really important to my process, understanding how, you know, I've been using music and working with musicians, but I really wanted to learn how I could use the sound in the way that I wanted to use it. So yeah, that was a you know, all bad things turn out well, I think, in the end. So
that's very positive.
Yeah, I'll try and be very positive about these experiences, but also you learn, because I don't want to stop working with people, I don't want to stop learning from people, but you learn, you know, how to form these collaborations in a successful way for both parties, you know, so both parties feel like they're growing and getting something from the situation, whether it be paying someone for what their knowledge, so that you can then go on and learn something and do something, or, you know, whatever it may be. Sorry, Emma.
No, sorry, getting overexcited. I was thinking about this idea of translation, because it seems like, because it's also what you're describing, and it's really interesting thinking about collaboration as a form of translation, that actually ideas are really complex, and that's great if they're ambitious in that three-dimensional way. You know, if you want to work with a dancer or a choreographer or a musician, and doing that as a 360 thing is like this, it's just amazing. I think that's often what's so exciting. But it also made me think about that idea of letting go, like when to hold the reins, like you say, and then how to let go. And I think that experience, I think often it's interesting thinking about workshops as a way to think about those things, because you can't hold, you don't know really who's going to come and what's going to happen and all those kind of things. And I think, so I did some workshops for Milton Keynes Art Centre, and I remember thinking like how to do this, on whether I should just do it on my own and just deliver, like, I don't know, a drawing workshop or I guess something quite straight. And it just was, it wasn't very exciting. It didn't feel like, you know, and I suppose it's that thing of wanting to translate something. I think that's where the translation feels like it's exciting, but working with someone else in order to then try and find a voice for a conversation that we didn't quite know how to put into a drawing or into a piece of text or into a, you know, and bring people along in that ride, in that like letting go kind of, you know, reverse vertigo thing.
I think very much that sense of, I think as artists, we need to be in control of our work, and you can become kind of control freak, but this element of also participation, and when I invite people to be in my work, it is a letting go, because I have no control really over you know, that's what adds that element of risk to a performance, to the work itself. It gives it life, it gives it animism, it brings a new thing in that is I very much need as an artist. That's sort of why I sort of create these situations for myself, and they can be quite stressful situations, but it's interesting how once you're in that and you're in that element of letting go, it can also bring so much sort of release for you as an artist as well.
Yeah, I think that's so relatable. And I think even if your practice is not so wide ranging as yours, Serena, that it still is kind of relevant, isn't it? Like, I just think, just when I'm painting in my studio, if I find I'm too comfortable with all the materials and what I'm doing, it's just, I can just feel it's so boring, I can't bear it, so I have to do something different, whether it just is like working at a different scale or using different materials or whatever. And I'm also really into the idea of working or collaborating with different kinds of people at the moment, and I'm working with a writer on something, and I don't really know at all how it's going to work out and what's going to happen, but I like that idea of being at the start of something, and the kind of whole process of it, I think, is the exciting thing. That thing about your next project, the thing you're thinking about, is always so great, isn't it? Because it's still in your head and could be anything, could be the most amazing thing ever that anybody's ever seen.
or the worst,
but who knows? All the possibilities are there.
So just, I'm experimenting a lot with things in my studio that aren't quite working, and that's the point of it, you know. Things fail and it's okay, but it's just that also someone coming into that conversation that might allow you to see it in a different way. And I do miss proper studio visits, and you know, the Zoom studio visit doesn't quite cut it. It's I find I'm failing quite big on Zoom. but that's okay.
They're a whole thing.
Anyway.
Yeah. I haven't had any, I don't think I've had any Zoom studio visits. Have you, Emma?
I have, and it's like, I've described this before as like having, I felt like I was Paul Daniels and Dimmer McGee and the magic trick and the guy in the box. I was literally like, and I was sweating a lot as well because I was quite nervous, and I was moving paintings around because I was trying not to move the camera around. So it was probably one of the most physical endurance exercises I've ever done in my life. And I wish I'd filmed it because it felt like a really good performance piece. And I got really high as well. So afterwards I was like giddy. I was really giddy on like the exercise and the endorphins, and then like, and also I was trying to talk. So I was, you know, sort of breathy. So it sounded a bit like a really weird, like turning myself on film. It was just really weird. So I would sort of recommend it as an experience. And it did go really well because they were really nice people, and it was a really, you know, it ended in a good way. So maybe that's why I'm framing it in it was a positive rather than a really negative thing. But I actually think there's something about Zoom studio, like studio visits are weird anyway, you know. That's a good, I'd love to have a collaborator that can help me do studio visits, because I do think someone arrives and often it's like, well, I don't really know what you want.
It's awkward. It's always so awkward. I'm not good at them at all.
It's hard. It's really hard. I think you're not really told about what they are and how to do it. And so actually the Zoom version was like, it was probably the best I've ever done. You know, I was like, this is me in my sweaty glory. And it felt like it was quite honest. It was like the most authentic version. Anyway,
yeah, maybe Zoom has made us all a little bit more forgiving about things as well. You know, we all know it's difficult for everybody, and the bad Wi-Fi connection and the echoes and the, I don't know, everything about it. I think we're just all a little bit nicer, maybe. Maybe it's helped,
well,
generally.
But I do think that's partly to do with this like proliferation of podcasts, which isn't a bad thing. I think there's something amazing about that. But this kind of this idea that it's like it's now open to anyone. It's the most accessible it's ever been. And if you know, if there's a bit of a dodgy connection, well, we're in lockdown. Everyone's got dodgy connection. Like everyone knows about Wi-Fi dropping out and not having the right stuff. And you know, it's kind of all people coming in, like the number of ones on Radio 4 where you've got someone's kid in the background. And you just think, this is brilliant. Like, it's so much more real.
I think podcasts are great, and I listen to absolutely loads of them in my studio when I'm working. So there can't be too many for me.
I agree. Yeah,
absolutely. So do you both teach? And how do you feel about that as a thing in terms of kind of generosity and passing on experience? Is it an important thing for you to do, Serena?
I do teach, I don't have a permanent contract anywhere, but obviously part of the fellowship I did, I was embedded in the university, so I had a lot of interaction with the students. But also I've done, I don't know how many artist talks this year, which has been really great. And I really enjoy that level of being able to sort of just talk to students about what I'm doing and then share that and do some studio tutorials. But yeah, that's always been part of my practice. And essentially I started as when I left university, when I left my degree, I started to be an arts educator and was working in galleries and all sorts of things, and that definitely informed this sort of activity of participation and communion in the work. So yeah, it's always been there. And it comes and goes, and it's there in different ways. And the YouTube channel is very much about it's educational. I label it as educational because I'm sort of showing people my process, which is a bit bonkers, but you know, it's my way of doing things. And I say that at the top. It's not the way to do things. But you know, it's also about reciprocity, that teaching. It's not just you telling someone something, it's you learn from students as much as you give them, you know, it's a reciprocal thing. So I think that, again, that sense of my work is very much always about learning something and pushing my knowledge boundaries and barriers and pushing them out the way. You know, that kind of energy is so important to me as an artist. So I think, you know, giving back in that way is essential, really.
And how about you, Emma?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's sort of similar. I mean, it's really weird. I've just got this weird flash childhood. I keep getting these like memories from childhood at the moment, which is really nice, but also quite bizarre. I think it's the pace change and lockdown, and I'm doing a lot of digging, which I think is like physically quite good to get you connected to your past. But mm-hmm. I'm just thinking, so both my parents were teachers and my brother's a teacher. And I remembered, I've forgotten this completely, but when I graduated, I went off the rails a bit in terms of dated someone a bit crazy and had this, you know, wild time. And then was a supply teacher when we broke up because I didn't have a job. And it was the most terrifying thing I think I've ever done in my whole life. But sort of amazing, actually. It was interesting as an experience. And I suppose it was just making me think about that role of the teacher and how hard it is. And I suppose that, you know, what we expect, that there's like so much in that role to deliver. And obviously we're talking sort of about more higher educational roles, but I think it's interesting to think about teachers at the moment and the how much they care as well, and the kind of demand that's put on them in terms of community. Like, do we really, like, what is that community and how do we protect that? But I think also that, I mean, I have taught a little bit, same thing, same capacity, sort of visiting artist, you know, temporary, on and off, in and out roles.
Does anybody have like a full-time prop, or you know, like a proper teaching contract? I kind of feel like hardly anyone does anymore. All visiting.
Yeah, which is maybe quite nice. I mean, I like the idea that it means that they're all different, and those students are getting a really different wide range of voices and different perspectives, which is great. But I do, you know, when I've done them, I've loved it. So it's made me go, oh, I really wish I could do that again, you know. And I also love studio visits and tutorials. So doing tutorials, you know, when you go in for a day, you do tutorials in various universities. And it is, you're right, you're completely right, Serena. It's this reciprocal, it's about listening as much as anything else. And then what you come away with at the end of the day is often completely phenomenal, like exhausting revelations, you know. So yeah, I think it's really important and exciting, and an important thing to be embedded in as much as you can, obviously physically and possibly, and also there's only so many roles, like you say, that are permanent. I also do a bit of lecturing on Sotheby's, which is a weird one, on like alternative curating. I suppose on the back of Bread and Jam, but really thinking about alternatives and the ecological aspects of the art world, like thinking about community and what's important in kind of a curating an artist-led space sense, to bring that voice into a domain which is maybe slightly more commercially minded or driven. Mm-hmm. So that's exciting.
Who's the audience for that? Is that an open, is that a course-led thing, or that you're working with the employees of Sotheby's?
No, it's a course-led. Yeah. I mean, there's great people at Sotheby's. All the art historians and tutors are amazing and hugely researched and qualified and exciting. You know, the librarian there is phenomenal. So it's a really interesting institution to be part of. And they're very keen for that voice, for someone to come in and sort of say, it's not just, you know, you can also just do this, or this is happening, or there's so many models within it. So it's sort of a passion. It's become a bit of a passion, this idea of what that is and how it's evolving. I guess it's so problematic too, you know, is the fact that a recession means there's more empty spaces, which then means artists can finally have spaces for free, and these kind of problems. So it's really, I feel like it's important to speak about, and it's important research, and it's interesting to be doing it across different courses, from like an MA course in curating to the beginners who've just started and doing a week's course or an evening program and that kind of thing. So
yeah, I think the whole artist run activity thing is something that needs to be studied a bit more. Maybe I have a vested interest, but
yeah, I mean, there's some great books out there though, and there are some amazing things that are, it feels like it's more prevalent now, but I think the problem is that the alternative is often understood to be someone like Hans Ulrika Bries, who started in his kitchen, and his methodology being quite alternative. But you know, within the alternative scene, that's hugely mainstream and financially stable. So it's like, it's how to really kind of open it up. And I think you're right, Kathy, like the diversity that exists is definitely underrepresented and under.
I wanted to ask you both actually about your experiences of working with artist-run organisations, if you have anything in particular that springs to mind.
Yeah, I work with Rhubarba Choir. Oh, well, Rhubarba as the artist-led collective, but I think they still have a choir. They invited lots of artists to come and collaborate with the choir. And at that point, I was just sort of, again, it was this sort of, what's your next idea, Serena? And it was that I was in my studio making these pots that I wanted people to sing into. And they came to me. It was just like a call out to the universe. And Rhubarba came back and went, we want you to come and we want to do things with your pots and sing into them. I was like, okay, great. But they were amazing. And they just, you know, with very little money, they made the thing happen. You know, their one agenda felt like it was just to support me rather than with an organization. There are so many sort of hidden agendas. I think transparency was key, and just, I felt very held and supported as an artist. I mean, I stayed for about 4 weeks with them and in one of their flats, you know, in their spare room. And, you know, it was brilliant, a brilliant experience and brilliant start to that. The beginning of me kind of merging sculpture and ceramics and sound together. So yeah, I have a lot to thank them for that experience. But also I don't know if all artist collectors are like this, but obviously, you know, a lot of organisations started as artist collectives. You've got the Chisenhale, the Collective up in Edinburgh. You know, a lot of these things start from this grassroots thing of wanting to hold and be generous to artists and care for each other, really, and support each other in making, like, you know, Emma's done with Bread and Jam, and, you know, it's amazing. So long will that continue, because I think it is the way forward in many ways.
Definitely. I think it's, yeah, long may there be new ones springing up all the time that are very ephemeral or develop into something else, or, you know, they're all different, aren't they? And I think it's so great that artists can do that and not just have to rely upon big institutions and commercial organisations to present them with opportunities. I think it's really a sort of vital part of the art world, that development. So I guess we're getting towards the end of our time, and so I'm going to ask you as a final question, what have you got coming up? What are you working on? What are you excited about? Maybe I'll ask Emma first of all.
I mean, the gem like paintings is what's in my mind. They don't exist yet, so obviously they're going to be great.
They're brilliant.
I'm working on, so I've got two group shows at the moment. One opens in Rome in June, Andrea Festa Fine Art, which is exciting because I guess at the moment we can't travel, and the idea of any form of international travel to me just feels really far away. So the idea that paintings can do that is really exciting. And also it's interesting, I was thinking about Italy whilst making them. So I feel like they're made with a different kind of like texture or timbre or sort of colour palette, like a different sort of information. So that was quite exciting. So that'll be fun to see that over there. And then, yeah, the other one's at AMPM, which is in London, at Great Titchfield Street at the moment, a massive group show called 10. And then in September, October, I've got a solo show with Neeru Ratnam Gallery in London in Soho. So I'm working on that at the minute as well, as well as lots of podcasts, just still editing the last one. So that's a constant kind of balancing act. But I'm doing the next, I've got the next three kind of planned and research.
So they're gonna carry on outside of lockdown
for now. Yeah, I mean, because I feel like we're still in something to do with it. I mean, we're not out of it, are we, in any, by any stretch. And I also feel like for the arts, it's going to get harder before it gets better. I think right now we're in this strange aftermath bubble where maybe people are supporting the arts more as individuals because they've got a bit more income and time. But I worry that that isn't going to be the case for much longer. And then what happens? And a bit like the financial crash, like what happened, you know, we were like 2 years behind. The art market suddenly was like, oh shit. So I just wonder, I'm almost like thinking about, I guess, trying to be ready for that in a hopeful way. And also in a way that I want to, I don't know, like think about sustainability. How can we sustain the things that we've learned and carry them forward when things still feel really frenetic and difficult and stressful? That doesn't sound very hopeful, but I am hopeful. But I am excited about what they're, you know, the possibility of discussing these things like as honestly as possible and what that can achieve.
Sounds great. And Serena, what have you got coming up?
Yeah. Well, I have just completed a DYCP grant thing from the Arts Council that was really about investigating how I used sound, and I did a lot of music theory, I did some coding, and so I'm hoping to sort of start pushing that into a new piece of work that's using my daughter's development of her voice. Over the last 20 months I've been recording her, her utterances, her babbling, and kind of the relationship between that emergence of our voices into being, well, being how we're speaking now, you know. So yeah, that sort of idea, but how it relates to music and melody and rhythm, and yeah, so that's been my kind of focus. But I'm kind of currently trying to find a way of using the vibrations of her voice to either print with, a bit like a woman called Megan Watts Hughes, Welsh singer from so there are a few things in the pipeline, but I there are a few projects, but I don't think I can talk about them yet, so because they're a bit not top secret, but again this sort of uncertainty of they're not totally 100% black and white, but we're talking
anyway. Thank you. I just want to say thank you to both of you for being here and chatting. It's been really great. I've really enjoyed it, and good luck with all your projects, and hopefully we'll speak again soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Out of Space is a podcast series produced by Space, London's largest artist studios provider. To learn more about the artists taking part and for further resources, please visit the What's On section of Space's website at www.spacestudios.org.